is Thursday, September 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the woman who accuses Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault is certain of his responsibility in the alleged incident.
So the trauma-related experience then is kind of locked there.
Chinese state media called President Donald Trump's election meddling allegations crazy, and a local art center helps aspiring artists change careers. It's all ahead. The woman who accuses Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her decades ago provided detailed and emotional testimony Thursday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Christine Blasey Ford told the committee she was terrified and that she was not there because she wanted to be, but that she believed it was her civic duty. She described the 1982 House party that she attended along with Kavanaugh, his friend Mark Judge, and others. She alleged that Kavanaugh and Judge locked her in a bedroom.
I was pushed onto the bed, and Brett got on top of me. He began running his hands over my body and grinding into me. I yelled, hoping that someone downstairs might hear me, and I tried to get away from him, but his weight was heavy. Brett groped me and tried to take off my clothes. He had a hard time because he was very inebriated, and because I was wearing a one-piece bathing suit underneath my clothing. I believed he was going to rape me. I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me.
Ford described how the alleged attack affected her.
Brett's assault on me drastically altered my life. For a very long time, I was too afraid and ashamed to tell anyone these details. I did not want to tell my parents that I, at age 15, was in a house without any parents present, drinking beer with boys. I convinced myself that because Brett did not rape me, I should just move on and just pretend that it didn't happen.
Senator Dianne Feinstein asked Ford about her certainty that Kavanaugh was responsible.
You are very clear about the attack, being pushed into the room. You say you don't know quite by whom, but that it was Brett Kavanaugh that covered your mouth to prevent you from screaming, and then you escaped. How are you so sure that it was he?
The same way that I'm sure that I'm talking to you right now. It's just basic memory functions, also just the level of norepinephrine and epinephrine in the brain that sort of, as you know, encodes that neurotransmitter encodes memories into the hippocampus, and so the trauma-related experience then is kind of locked there, whereas other details kind of drift.
So what you are telling us is this could not be a case of mistaken identity.
Absolutely not.
I'm joined now by VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Well, Michael, this has been a very powerful testimony.
Sarah, until a few hours ago, the Americans had no idea, really, who Christine Blasey Ford was. We all knew of the accusation that she had leveled against Judge Brett Kavanaugh, but this was her opportunity, and it's still going on, to tell her story. And she was composed. She often spoke in a halting voice, a very emotion-laden voice. But she was absolutely crystal clear in repeated questioning as to what transpired, according to her, at that house party in 1982 and who committed the act.
And it should be noted she was just 15 years old at the time. And later on in her adult years, she has pursued a career in psychology. So she knows quite a bit about trauma.
She did, in fact, engage in a bit of, I don't know, self-analysis. She teaches psychology. And she often gave absolute medical explanations for her own brain process in processing what she says happened to her.
Now, there have been repeated questions, including by Senator Charles Grassley, about why this information, which has been so controversial, why this did not come to light earlier.
Yes, and California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein has been in the hot seat a little bit concerning this. She ultimately did turn over this information, and there was some question as to why it did not come to light sooner. There was a bit of back and forth between Feinstein and Grassley and other members on the committee before Christine Blasey Ford testified. And the upshot was that Feinstein says that she was not able to provide the information so long as Ford was speaking without coming forward and actually naming herself as an unidentified witness.
Well, now Kavanaugh is scheduled to testify later today. What will he be facing?
Well, let's just say that this entire proceeding obviously is not a criminal trial. No one is going to be declared guilty or not guilty at the end of all of this. The question is really one of credibility, as 100 senators are going to be called on to decide whether Judge Kavanaugh deserves a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. I can't speak for all Americans, but certainly Dr. Ford did speak very resolutely about what she says happened to her. She did not crack under the pressure. She was clearly very nervous. And then it will be Brett Kavanaugh's time. It will be his chance to give his version of events and to protest his innocence, as he has done for the 2 weeks since this story first came to light.
Is it likely that the Senate vote on Kavanaugh's nomination will take place on Friday?
That remains to be seen. The pressure on senators, particularly Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee, is extreme. And we do have an election coming up quite shortly, and where control of the Senate could be decided. This is a moment of extreme pressure for Republicans, and honestly, from my vantage point, I could just as easily see the Republican-controlled committee going ahead with the vote or deciding to put it off. And I suspect that they will make that decision after meeting and conferring among their own members after this hearing.
All right. Thanks very much, Michael. That's Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The UN Human Rights Council establishes a team to document crimes in Myanmar. Iraqi Kurds will elect a new parliament on Sunday, and India's Supreme Court rules adultery is no longer a crime. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists studying data gathered by the European Space Agency's Gaia mission say they think one of four stars may have been home to our solar system's first interstellar visitor, Oumuamua. It's thought that the cigar-shaped comet was ejected from a solar system when planets were still forming. The Gaia data made it possible for the scientists to create a scenario that provided a way of looking back at Oumuamua's route through the cosmos and some of the stars it may have encountered along the way over the last several million years. According to the scientists, the four stars are dwarfs, with masses comparable or less than our Sun, and that the interstellar comet passed close to them between 1 and 7 million years ago. Further research is needed to further pinpoint Oumuamua's home star and determine the mechanism that ejected it. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, some would-be artists receive some encouragement. China China is rejecting accusations from President Donald Trump that Beijing is meddling in the upcoming U.S. elections, with some Chinese media calling the suggestion crazy talk and others noting the remarks were just campaign strategy. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide tells me about Chinese reaction to Trump's claim.
China's initial response at the UN yesterday was a flat denial of these accusations, and they have continued to, at least officials have continued to kind of stress that fact that China does not interfere in other countries' affairs. At the regular press briefing for the foreign ministry today, that's what the spokesman had to say, again, kind of reiterating what Foreign Minister Wang Yi said at the United Nations. He also said that everyone in the international community knows which country interferes the most in other countries' affairs. Obviously, he did not mention the United States by name, but that's clearly who he was referring to. And there was an emphasis, at least from officials, that the United States needs to stop slandering China and stop this kind of behavior towards China. This, again, kind of plays into this continual message we've had all along since this trade dispute has begun, that everything is really the U.S.'s fault. It's about the U.S.'s actions. It doesn't have anything to do with China's own economic policies, its trade practices, its cyber theft and IPR violations. So we continue to see a lot of that. There was also some, you know, lengthy comment in state media as well, or party-backed media. The Global Times had a story about what Trump had to say and his accusations that China was meddling in the midterm elections. The Global Times called what Trump had to say a sort of creative campaign strategy by trying to link China and blame China. But the Global Times argued that, you know, in this case, it said the White House needs to kind of take a step back and look at what's happening. And really, the Global Times argued that it's the United States' fault or the administration's fault for what is happening. And if Trump continues with his approach to the trade relations, that the midterm elections won't be the only election that is at risk. The article op-ed also suggested that Trump's reelection could be at risk as well. So all around, a lot of comment denying it. But at the same time, I don't really know if the comments, especially in the Global Times, were that assuring, because, you know, they said that if Trump does continue with what he's doing, that the Republicans are going to suffer, you know, that the people in the United States are going to suffer, almost, you know, kind of denying it, but yet also reaffirming that there's a connection there.
That's kind of interesting, considering China's, you know, criticism of the U.S. trying to interfere in its internal policies.
Yes. Yeah, it's very interesting. And this whole China's non-interference policy over the past few years has really been going through a transformation, and more to the point that we're seeing China getting more involved. And as of recently, there was when we had this Africa forum, there was an official who also said that, you know, there are instances where China does have to get involved, and it does have to, he didn't say interfere, of course, because that's their traditional policy to not interfere, but China is interfering in many different ways. It's getting involved in foreign affairs of other countries and regions, and it's a fact. So to hear, you know, Wang Yi say that China has this long-standing tradition that it doesn't interfere, well, it's really not the case anymore.
Even though President Trump has been critical of China's trade policies, he keeps saying that he has a good personal relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Yes, and yesterday he said that friendship may not be as good as it used to be, or it may be over, and maybe now he respects me. He did raise some questions at that press conference about the friendship and where it stands now. Yes, that's something that he has been saying for some time now. Whether or not that friendship can weather this storm is increasingly, I think, in doubt. And the events over the past week, really, and Trump's comments, there was a remark made earlier this week by the foreign ministry saying that, you know, we would like to talk, but we can't really talk with the tariffs that Trump has put on us because that is like a knife to our throat. So both sides are very, very much kind of digging their heels in.
Bill Ide reporting from Beijing. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is expected to make his fourth trip to Pyongyang next month, this time to arrange for a second U.S.-North Korea summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He met with his North Korean counterpart in New York on Wednesday. Trump said while global sanctions will remain in place against the North, he's hopeful a breakthrough will take place on denuclearization. Just last week, Pompeo said he expected denuclearization talks to be complete by the end of Trump's first term in January 2021. This week, Trump dismissed any timeline, saying a breakthrough could occur in 2 years, 3 years, or 5 months. Korea Society Senior Director Stephen Norper tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, abandoning a timeline suggests Trump recognizes the complexity of the talks that could become a lengthy step-by-step process.
The administration has basically taken a tact of not trying to define it by time, but urging patience. So an incremental approach, and it seems to be one that allows for a commitment to denuclearization, but also for the North Koreans, you know, really to come to the table. It's a complex process. It may take time.
Mr. Trump, chairing the UN Security Council for a time on Wednesday, said many positive things are happening behind the scenes on North Korea away from the media, and he also touted his very good relationship with Kim Jong-un.
The North Koreans certainly seem to want to make progress, at least as Moon Jae-in has expressed in New York this week. It's a process that seems to have some momentum.
How important was the meeting between Pompeo and his North Korean counterpart?
Significant in that it just shows that there is a communication that is open, that the South Koreans in particular have fostered, and that seems to have some durability. Both the U.S. president and the North Korean leader seem to need this process. The North Korean leader for economic viability and sustainability, which helps his regime. The U.S. president for a foreign policy victory ahead of the midterm election and for his own legacy. And South Korean President Moon seems to understand that. He's pushing hard this week in New York, now on his departure, having really laid a foundation for at least the next step, which would be a second summit.
Asked by broadcast interviewers if Chairman Kim agreed to allow international inspectors into nuclear sites, Pompeo said yes, while adding that verification is important in any nuclear agreement. Is this a key concession?
Oh, absolutely. And it's the biggest takeaway from the Pyongyang Declaration, meaning the meeting between the South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And clearly, the need to create a declaration of North Korean capabilities. Also, verification by international inspectors, and it seemed that Kim was amenable. So that is a huge takeaway and something that the U.S. and the international community insist is of paramount concern.
Stephen, a lot has been said about what North Korea wants in return. Do we know yet?
Well, North Korea wants economic opening. It wants a back off of sanctions. And by way of that, it's seeking viability. North Korea wants to secure its regime, both through a security guarantee from the United States, meaning an end-of-war statement, and also through the promise of some sort of economic benefits, investment in the United States, and certainly investment from South Korea, which seems bent given the improvements in inter-Korean relations.
Stephen Norper of the Korea Society. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Thank you.
This is International Edition. Earlier this year, two artists in Leesburg, Virginia, founded an art space where they could work and teach other art lovers as well. Part retail business, part studio, Clay and Metal Loft helps aspiring local artists gain the skills and confidence they need to start their own business. But as Faisal Masri tells us, the founders have a bigger dream. They want their space to energize the community. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Make that round, and then we're going to stick our thumb in.
In the clay hand-building class, ceramist Amy Manson shares some of her techniques with participants who come twice a week.
Today's project is hand sculpting, and sculpting through a pinch pot process, a pumpkin. So you're making two pinch pots, enclosing them to make a round orb, and then sculpting it to look like a pumpkin. The first time might be a little scary. They're not sure. They're a little intimidated on how hard to push or how the clay is going to react. But after one time, they get a little more confident. Once you've got the air trap, you can still sculpt and fix and do what you need to do.
Many of the students have a background in arts and want to hone their skills and learn different techniques. Barbara Johnson started doing pottery 3 years ago.
Having your hands in clay is just this calming kind of thing. And it's so creative because you may start out thinking you're going to make this piece, and it turns into something totally different.
Recently, Johnson has started selling her work.
I'm humbled a lot of times when someone says that they want to purchase, you know, my things and have them in their home.
Manson's partner, her friend Anne Andre, is a jeweler who creates transformative pieces, like a pendant that can also be worn as a ring.
5 years ago, really started looking to see where we could have this business model. And we thought, wouldn't it be great to do something that was more clay and jewelry making, because we didn't see anything like that before.
This is a perfect fit.
Andre teaches jewelry making classes.
They hammer the metal, they get an effect, you know, that they never thought they could do themselves. They form something like a bracelet, and it's just, they're excited. They think, I made this. And they go out wearing it, which is really nice.
That's how Jennifer Mettish feels when she wears the pendant she made.
I love turquoise. I'm a country girl, grew up around horses. Turquoise has always been just kind of a symbol of that rustic look.
Considering a second career beyond horses, she's finding a potential in jewelry making.
I feel that there has been such a revival of handmade items that people, they're more willing to pay for something that is made by a single artist than something that is mass produced.
And then you can feel how much clay is in the bottom.
The founders of Clay and Metal Loft want to be part of that revival. Through summer camps, they want to inspire kids. And through their monthly Ladies' Night workshops, they try to help busy professionals unwind. Their goal is to become a creative, fun space for the entire community. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. We have a range of stories, including more on the continuing Kavanaugh hearings. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter following VOA News, either on the radio or online at voanews.com/encounter. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.